Chapter 30. The 5th of September. The delay afforded by the agent of the House of Thompson and French, at the moment when Morel expected it least, appeared to the poor shipowner one of those returns of good fortune which announce to a man that fate is at length weary of wasting her spite upon him. The same day he related to his wife, to Emmanuel, and his daughter what had occurred to him, and a ray of hope, if not tranquillity, returned to the family. Unfortunately, however, Morel had not only engagements with the House of Thompson and French, who had shown themselves so considerate towards him, and, as he had said, in business he had correspondents and not friends. When he reflected deeply, he could by no means account for this generous conduct on the part of Thompson and French towards him, and could only attribute it to the selfish reflection of the firm. "We had better support a man who owes us nearly 300,000 francs, and have that 300,000 francs at the end of 3 months, than hasten his ruin and have 6 or 8% of capital." Unfortunately, whether from hate or blindness, all Morel's correspondents did not reflect similarly, and some made even a contrary reflection. The bills signed by Morel were thus presented at his office with scrupulous exactitude, and, thanks to the delay granted by the Englishman, were paid by Coclès with equal punctuality. Coclès thus remained in his accustomed tranquillity. It was Morel alone who remembered with alarm that if he had to repay on the 15th the 100,000 francs of Monsieur de Bourville, and on the 30th the 32,500 francs of bills, for which, as well as the debt due to the inspector of prisons, he had time granted, he must be a ruined man. The opinion of all the commercial men was that under the reverses which had successively weighed down Morel, it was impossible for him to stand against it. Great, therefore, was the astonishment when they saw the end of the month come, and he fulfilled all his engagements with his usual punctuality. Still, confidence was not restored to all minds, and the general voice postponed only until the end of the month the complete ruin of the unfortunate shipowner. The month passed amidst unheard-of efforts on the part of Morel to get in all his resources. Formerly, his paper at any date was taken with confidence, and was even in request. Morel now tried to negotiate bills at 90 days only, and found all the banks closed. Fortunately, Morel had some monies coming in on which he could rely, and as they reached him he found himself in a condition to meet his engagements when the end of July came. The agent of Thompson and French had not been again seen at Marseille. The day after, or 2 days after his visit to Morel, he had disappeared, and as in that city he had had no intercourse but with the mayor, the inspector of prisons, and Monsieur Morel, his appearance left no other trace than the different remembrances of him which these three persons retained. As to the sailors of the Pharaon, it seemed that they must have found some engagement, for they had disappeared also. Captain Gomard, recovered from his illness, had returned from Palma. He hesitated to present himself at Morel's, but the owner, hearing of his arrival, went to him. The worthy shipowner knew, from Penelon's recital, of the captain's brave conduct during the storm, and tried to console him. He brought him also the amount of his wages, which Captain Gomard had not dared to apply for. As he descended the staircase, Morel met Penelon, who was going up. Penelon had, it would seem, made good use of his money, for he was newly clad. When he saw his employer, the worthy tar seemed much embarrassed, drew on one side into the corner of the landing-place, passed his quid from one cheek to the other, stared stupidly with his great eyes, and only acknowledged the squeeze of the hand which Morel, as usual, gave him by a slight pressure in return. Morel attributed Penelon's embarrassment to the elegance of his attire. It was evident the good fellow had not gone to such an expense on his own account. He was no doubt engaged on board some other vessel, and thus his bashfulness arose from the fact of his not having, if we may so express ourselves, worn mourning for the Pharaon longer. Perhaps he had come to tell Captain Gomard of his good luck, and to offer him employment from his new master.
"Worthy fellow," said Morel as he went away, "may your new master love you as I loved you, and be more fortunate than I have been."
August rolled by in unceasing efforts on the part of Morel to renew his credit or revive the old. On the 20th of August it was known at Marseille that he had taken a place in the mail coach, and then it was said that it was at the end of the month the docket was to be struck, and Morel had gone away before, that he might not be present at this cruel act. but had left his chief clerk Emmanuel and his cashier Coclès to meet it. But, contrary to all expectation, when the 31st of August came, the house opened as usual, and Coclès appeared behind the grating of the counter, examined all bills presented with the same scrutiny, and, from first to last, paid all with the same precision. There came in, moreover, two repayments which M. Morel had anticipated, and which Coclès paid as punctually as those bills which the shipowner had accepted. All this was incomprehensible, and then, with a tenacity peculiar to prophets of bad news, the failure was put off until the end of September. On the 1st, Morel returned. He was awaited by his family with extreme anxiety, for from this journey to Paris they hoped a last means of safety would arrive. Morel had thought of Danglars, who was now immensely rich, and had lain under great obligations to Morel in former days, since to him it was owing that Danglars entered the service of the Spanish banker, with whom had commenced his vast wealth. It was said at this moment that Danglars was worth from 200,000 to 300,000 pounds, and had unlimited credit. Danglars, then, without taking a crown from his pocket, could save Morel. He had but to pass his word for a loan, and Morel was saved. Morel had long thought of Danglars, but there are those instinctive revoltings impossible to control, and Morel had delayed as long as possible before he had recourse to this last resource. And Morel was right, for he returned home, borne down by all the humiliation of a refusal. Yet on his arrival Morel did not utter a complaint, nor say one harsh word. He embraced his weeping wife and daughter, pressed Emmanuel's hand with friendly warmth, and then, going to his private room on the second floor, had sent for Coclès. "Then," said the two females to Emmanuel, "we are indeed ruined." It was agreed in a brief council held amongst them that Julie should write to her brother, who was in garrison at Nîmes, to come to them as speedily as possible. The poor woman felt instinctively that they required all their strength to support the blow that impended. Besides, Maximilian Morel, though hardly 22, had great influence over his father. He was a strong-minded, upright young man. At the time when he decided on his profession, his father had no desire to choose for him, but had consulted young Maximilian's taste. He had at once declared for a military life, and had in consequence studied hard, passed brilliantly through the École Polytechnique, and left it as sub-lieutenant of the 53rd of the line. For a year he had held his rank and expected promotion on the first vacancy. In his regiment, Maximilian Morel was noted as the most rigid observer not only of the obligations imposed on a soldier, but also of the duties of a man, and he thus gained the name of the Stoic. We need hardly say that many of those who gave him this epithet repeated it because they had heard it, and did not even know what it meant. This was the young man whom his mother and sister called to their aid to sustain them under the grave circumstances which they felt they would soon have to endure. They had not mistaken the gravity of this event, for the moment after Morel had entered his cabinet with Coclès, Julie saw the latter leave it pale, trembling, and his features betraying the utmost consternation. She would have questioned him as he passed by her, but the worthy creature hastened down the staircase with unusual precipitation, and only raised his hands to heaven, and exclaimed, "Oh, mademoiselle, mademoiselle, what a dreadful misfortune! Who could ever have believed it?" A moment afterwards Julie saw him go upstairs, carrying two or three heavy ledgers, a pocket-book, and a bag of money. Morel examined the ledgers, opened the pocket-book, and counted the money. All his funds amounted to 6,000 or 8,000 francs. His expectancies up to the 5th to 4,000 or 5,000, which, making the best of everything, gave him 14,000 francs to meet bills amounting to 287,500 francs. He could not make such a proposal. However, when Morel went down to his dinner, he appeared very composed. This calmness was more alarming to the two women than the deepest dejection would have been. After dinner, Morel usually went out, and used to take his coffee at the club of the Fosséens, and read the Semaphore. But this day he did not leave the house, but returned to his office. As to Coclès, he seemed completely bewildered. For part of the day he went into the courtyard, seated himself on a stone with his head bare, and exposed to a sun of 30 degrees. Emmanuel tried to comfort the females, but his eloquence faltered. The young man was too well acquainted with the business of the house not to feel that a great catastrophe hung over the Morel family. Night came. The two women had watched, hoping that when he left his room, Morel would come to them. But they heard him pass before their door, and trying to conceal the noise of his footsteps. They listened. He went into his sleeping room and fastened the door inside. Madame Morel sent her daughter to bed, and half an hour after Julie had retired, she rose, took off her shoes, and went stealthily along the passage, to see through the keyhole what her husband was doing. In the passage, she saw a retreating shadow. It was Julie who, uneasy herself, had anticipated her mother. The young lady went towards Madame Morel.
"He is writing," she said.
They had understood each other without speaking. Madame Morel looked again through the keyhole. Morel was writing. But Madame Morel remarked, what her daughter had not observed, that her husband was writing on stamped paper. The terrible idea that he was writing his will flashed across her. She shuddered, and yet had not strength to utter a word. Next day, Monsieur Morel seemed as calm as ever, went into his office as usual, came to his breakfast punctually, and then, after dinner, placed his daughter beside him, took her head in his arms, and held her for a long time against his bosom. In the evening, Julie told her mother that although so calm in appearance, she had remarked that her father's heart beat violently. The two next days passed almost similarly. On the evening of the 4th of September, Monsieur Morel asked his daughter for the key of his cabinet. Julie trembled at this request, which seemed to her of bad omen. Why did her father ask for this key which she always kept, and which was only taken from her in childhood as a punishment? The young girl looked at Morel.
"What have I done wrong, father?" she said, "that you should take this key from me?"
"Nothing, my dear,"
replied the unhappy man, the tears starting to his eyes at this simple question.
"Nothing, only I want it."
Julie made a pretense to feel for the key.
"I must have left it in my room," she said.
And she went out, but instead of going to her apartment, she hastened to consult Emmanuel. "Do not give this key to your father," said he, "and tomorrow morning, if possible, do not quit him for a moment." She questioned Emmanuel, but he knew nothing, or would not say it if he did. During the night, between the 4th and 5th of September, Madame Morel remained listening for every sound, and until 3 o'clock in the morning she heard her husband pacing the room in great agitation. It was 3 o'clock when he threw himself on the bed. The mother and daughter passed the night together. They had expected Maximilian since the previous evening. At 8 o'clock in the morning, Morel entered their chamber. He was calm, but the agitation of the night was legible in his pale and careworn visage. They did not dare to ask him how he had slept. Morel was kinder to his wife, more affectionate to his daughter than he had ever been. He could not cease gazing at and kissing the sweet girl. Julie, mindful of Emmanuel's request, was following her father when he quitted the room, but he said to her quickly,
"Remain with your mother, dearest."
Julie wished to accompany him.
"I wish you to do so," he said.
This was the first time Morel had ever so spoken, but he said it in a tone of paternal kindness, and Julie did not dare refuse compliance. She remained at the same spot, standing mute and motionless. An instant afterwards the door opened, she felt two arms encircle her, and a mouth pressed her forehead. She looked up and uttered an exclamation of joy.
"Maximilian, my dearest brother!" she cried.
At these words Madame Morel rose and threw herself into her son's arms. "Mother," said the young man, looking alternately at Madame Morel and her daughter, "what has occurred? What has happened? Your letter has frightened me, and I have come hither with all speed."
"Julie," said Madame Morel, making a sign to the young man, "go and tell your father that Maximilian has just arrived."
The young lady rushed out of the apartment, but on the first step of the staircase she found a man holding a letter in his hand.
"Are you not Mademoiselle Julie Morel?" inquired the man with a strong Italian accent.
"Yes, sir," replied Julie, with hesitation. "What is your pleasure?
I do not know you."
"Read this letter," he said, handing it to her.
Julie hesitated.
"It concerns the best interests of your father," said the messenger.
The young girl hastily took the letter from him. She opened it quickly and read, "Go this moment to the Allée de Meillan, Enter the house number 15. Ask the porter for the key of the room on the fifth floor. Enter the apartment. Take from the corner of the mantelpiece a purse netted in red silk, and give it to your father. It is important that he should receive it before 11 o'clock. You promised to obey me implicitly. Remember your oath. Sinbad the Sailor. The young girl uttered a joyful cry, raised her eyes, looked round to question the messenger, but he had disappeared. She cast her eyes again over the note to peruse it a second time, and saw there was a postscript. She read, "It is important that you should fulfil this mission in person and alone. If you go accompanied by any other person, or should anyone else present themselves, the porter will reply that he does not know anything about it." This postscript was a great check to the young girl's joy. Was there nothing to fear? Was there not some snare laid for her? Her innocence had kept her in ignorance of the dangers that might assail a young girl of her age, but there is no need to know danger in order to fear it. Indeed, it may be observed that it is usually unknown perils that inspire the greatest terror. Julie hesitated, and resolved to take counsel. Yet by a singular feeling, it was neither to her mother nor her brother that she applied, but to Emmanuel. She hastened down and told him what had occurred on the day when the agent of the house of Thompson and French had come to her father's, related the scene on the staircase, repeated the promise she had made, and showed him the letter.
"You must go then, mademoiselle," said Emmanuel.
"Go there?" murmured Julie.
"Yes, I will accompany you."
"But did you not read that I must be alone?" said Julie.
"And you shall be alone," replied the young man. "I will await you at the corner of the Rue du Musée, and if you are so long absent as to make me uneasy, I will hasten to rejoin you, and woe to him of whom you shall have cause to complain to me."
"Then, Emmanuel," said the young girl with hesitation, "it is your opinion that I should obey this invitation?"
"Yes. Did not the messenger say your father's safety was in it?"
"But what danger threatens him, then, Emmanuel?" she asked.
Emmanuel hesitated a moment, but his desire to make Julie decide immediately made him reply.
"Listen," he said, "today is the 5th of September, is it not?"
"Yes."
"Today, then, at 11 o'clock, your father has nearly 300,000 francs to pay?"
"Yes, we know that."
"Well, then," continued Emmanuel, "we have not 15,000 francs in the house."
"What will happen then?"
"Why, if today, before 11 o'clock, your father has not found someone who will come to his aid, he will be compelled at 12 o'clock to declare himself a bankrupt."
"Oh, come, then, come," cried she, hastening away with the young man.
During this time, Madame Morel had told her son everything. The young man knew quite well that after the succession of misfortunes which had befallen his father, great changes had taken place in the style of living and housekeeping, but he did not know that matters had reached such a point. He was thunderstruck. Then, rushing hastily out of the apartment, he ran upstairs expecting to find his father in his cabinet, but he rapped there in vain. Whilst he was yet at the door of the cabinet, he heard the bedroom door open, turned, and saw his father. Instead of going direct to his cabinet, Monsieur Morel had returned to his bedchamber, which he was only this moment quitting. Morel uttered a cry of surprise at the sight of his son, of whose arrival he was ignorant. He remained motionless on the spot, pressing with his left hand something he had concealed under his coat. Maximilian sprung down the staircase and threw his arms round his father's neck, but suddenly he recoiled and placed his hand on Morel's breast.
"Father," he exclaimed, turning pale as death, "what are you going to do with a brace of pistols under your coat?"
"Oh, this is what I feared," said Morel.
"Father, father, in heaven's name," exclaimed the young man, "what are these weapons for?"
"Maximilian,"
replied Morel, looking fixedly at his son,
"you are a man, and a man of honour. Come, I will explain to you."
And with a firm step Morel went up to his cabinet, whilst Maximilian followed him, trembling as he went. Morel opened the door and closed it behind his son, then, crossing the anteroom, went to his desk, on which he placed the pistols, and pointed with his finger to an open ledger. In this ledger was made out an exact balance sheet of affairs. Morel had to pay, within half an hour, 287,500 francs. All he possessed was 15,257 francs.
"Read,"
said Morel. The young man was overwhelmed as he read. Morel said not a word. What could he say? What need he add to such a desperate proof in figures? "And you have done all that is possible, father, to meet this disastrous result?" asked the young man after a moment's pause.
"I have," replied Morel.
"You have no money coming in, on which you can rely?"
"None."
"You have exhausted every resource?"
"All."
"And in half an hour," said Maximilian in a gloomy voice, "our name is dishonoured."
"Blood washes out dishonour," said Morel.
"You are right, father. I understand you." Then extending his hand towards one of the pistols, he said, "There is one for you and one for me. Thanks." Morel checked his hand.
"Your mother, your sister, who will support them?"
A shudder ran through the young man's frame. "Father," he said, "do you reflect that you are bidding me to live?"
"Yes, I do bid you," answered Morel. "It is your duty.
You have a calm, strong mind, Maximilian. Maximilian, you are no ordinary man.
I desire nothing, I command nothing. I only say to you, examine my position as if it were your own, and then judge for yourself."
The young man reflected an instant, then an expression of sublime resignation appeared in his eyes, and with a slow and sad gesture he took off his two epaulets, the marks of his rank. "Be it so, then, father," he said, extending his hand to Morel. "Die in peace, my father. I will live." Morel was about to cast himself on his knees before his son, but Maximilian caught him in his arms, and those two noble hearts were pressed against each other for a moment.
"You know it is not my fault," said Morel.
Maximilian smiled. "I know, father, you are the most honourable man I have ever known."
"Good, my son. And now all is said. Go now and rejoin your mother and sister."
"My father," said the young man, bending his knees,
"bless me."
Morel took his head between his two hands, drew him towards him, and kissing his forehead several times, said,
"Oh, yes, yes, I bless you in my own name, and in the name of three generations of irreproachable men, who say by my voice, the edifice which misfortune has destroyed, Providence may build up again. On seeing me die such a death, the most inexorable will have pity on you. To you, perhaps, they will accord the time they have refused to me. Try that the word of disgrace be never pronounced. Go to work, labour, young man, struggle ardently and courageously. Live yourself, your mother and sister, with the most rigid economy, so that from day to day the property of those whom I leave in your hands may augment and fructify. Reflect how glorious a day it will be, how grand, how solemn that day of complete restoration, on which you will say in this very office, 'My father died because he could not do what I have this day done, but he died calmly and peaceably because in dying he knew what I should do.'"
"My father, my father," cried the young man, "why should you not live?"
"If I live, all would be changed. If I live, interest would be converted into doubt, pity into hostility. If I live, I am only a man who has broken his word, failed in his engagements, in fact, only a bankrupt. If, on the contrary, I die, remember, Maximilian, my corpse is that of an honest but unfortunate man. Living, my best friends would avoid my house. Dead, all Marseille will follow me in tears to my last home. Living, you would feel shame at my name. Dead, you may raise your head and say, 'I am the son of him you killed, because, for the first time, he has been compelled to fail in his word.'"
The young man uttered a groan, but appeared resigned.
"And now," said Morel, "leave me alone, and endeavour to keep your mother and sister away."
"Will you not see my sister once more?" asked Maximilian. A last but final hope was concealed by the young man in the effect of this interview, and therefore he had suggested it. Morel shook his head.
"I saw her this morning and bade her adieu."
"Have you no particular commands to leave with me, my father?" inquired Maximilian in a faltering voice.
"Yes, my son, and a sacred command."
"Say it, my father."
"The house of Thompson and French is the only one who, from humanity, or it may be selfishness, it is not for me to read men's hearts, have had any pity for me. His agent, who will in 10 minutes present himself to receive the amount of a bill of 287,500 francs, I will not say granted, but offered me 3 months. Let this house be the first repaid, my son, and respect this man."
"Father, I will," said Maximilian.
"And now once more adieu," said Morel. "Go, leave me. I would be alone. You will find my will in the secretaire in my bedroom."
The young man remained standing and motionless, having but the force of will and not the power of execution.
"Hear me, Maximilian," said his father. "Suppose I were a soldier, like you, and ordered to carry a certain redoubt, and you knew I must be killed in the assault, would you not say to me, as you said just now, 'Go, father, for you are dishonoured by delay, and death is preferable to shame'?"
"Yes, yes," said the young man. "Yes," and once again embracing his father with convulsive pressure, he said, "Be it so, my father," and he rushed out of the cabinet. When his son had left him, Morel remained an instant standing with his eyes fixed on the door. Then, putting forth his arm, he pulled the bell. After a moment's interval, Coclès appeared. It was no longer the same man. The fearful convictions of the 3 last days had crushed him. This thought, "The house of Morel is about to stop payment," bent him to the earth more than 20 years would otherwise have done.
"My worthy Coclès," said Morel, in a tone impossible to describe, "do you remain in the antechamber? When the gentleman who came 3 months ago, the agent of the house of Thompson and French, arrives, announce his arrival to me."
Coclès made no reply. He made a sign with his head, went into the anteroom, and seated himself. Morel fell back in his chair, his eyes fixed on the clock. There were 7 minutes left, that was all. The hand moved on with incredible rapidity. It seemed to him as if he saw it progress. What then passed, at this final moment of time, in the mind of this man, who, still young, had by a course of reasoning, false perhaps, but at least specious, was about to separate himself from all he loved in the world, and quit life which possessed for him all domestic delights, it is impossible to express, to form the slightest idea of his feelings, he must have been seen with his brow bathed in perspiration, yet resigned, his eyes moistened with tears and yet raised to heaven. The clock hand moved on. The pistols were cocked. He stretched forth his hand, took one up, and murmured his daughter's name. Then he laid down the mortal weapon, took up his pen, and wrote a few words. It seemed to him as if he had not taken a sufficient farewell of his beloved daughter. Then he turned again to the clock. He no longer counted by minutes, but by seconds. He took up the deadly weapon again, his mouth half opened and his eyes fixed on the clock, and then shuddered at the click of the trigger as he cocked the pistol. At this moment of mortal agony, a damp, colder than death, passed over his brow, an agony stronger than death clutched at his heartstrings. He heard the door of the staircase creak on its hinges. The clock gave its warning to strike 11. The door of his cabinet opened. Morel did not turn round. He expected these words of Coclès, "The agent of Thompson and French." He placed the muzzle of the pistol between his teeth. Suddenly he heard a cry. It was his daughter's voice. He turned and saw Julie. The pistol fell from his hands.
"My father!" cried the young girl, out of breath and half dead with joy. "Saved! You are saved!"
And she threw herself into his arms, holding in her extended hand a red netted silk purse.
"Saved, my child," said Morel. "What do you mean?"
"Yes, saved, saved, see, see," said the young girl.
Morel took the purse and started as he did so, for a vague remembrance reminded him that it once belonged to himself. At one end was the bill for the 287,500 francs receipted. At the other was a diamond as large as a hazelnut, with these words on a small slip of parchment. "Julie's dowry." Morel passed his hand over his brow. It seemed to him a dream. At this moment the clock struck 11. The sound vibrated as if each stroke of the hammer struck Morel's heart.
"Explain, my child," he said. "Explain. Where did you find this purse?"
in a house in the Allée de Meillan, number 15, on the corner of a mantelpiece, in a small room on the fifth floor.
But, cried Morel, this purse is not yours.
Julie handed to her father the letter she had received in the morning.
And did you go alone?
Asked Morel, after he had read it.
Emmanuel accompanied me, father. He was to have waited for me at the corner of the Rue du Musée, but strange to say, he was not there when I returned.
Monsieur Morel! Exclaimed a voice on the stairs. Monsieur Morel!
It is his voice, said Julie. At this moment Emmanuel entered, his countenance full of animation and joy.
The Pharaon! He cried. The Pharaon!
What? What the Pharaon? Are you mad, Emmanuel? You know the vessel is lost.
The Pharaon, sir! They signal the Pharaon! The Pharaon is entering the harbour!
Morel fell back in his chair. His strength was failing him. His understanding, weakened by such events, refused to comprehend such incredible, unheard-of, fabulous facts. But his son came in.
"Father," cried Maximilian, "how could you say the Pharaon was lost? The watchtower has signalled her, and they say she is now coming into port."
"My dear friends," said Morel, "if this were so, it must be a miracle of heaven. Impossible! Impossible!"
But what was real and not less incredible was the purse he held in his hand, the acceptance receipted, the splendid diamond.
"Ah, sir!" exclaimed Cocles. "What can it mean? The Pharaon!"
"Come, my dear," said Morel, rising from his seat. "Let us go and see, and heaven have pity upon us if it be false intelligence."
They all went out, and on the stairs met Madame Morel, who had been afraid to go up into the cabinet. In an instant they were at the Canebière. There was a crowd on the pier. All the crowd gave way before Morel.
"The Pharaon! The Pharaon!"
said every voice. And wonderful to say, in front of the Tower of Saint-Jean was a ship bearing on her stern these words printed in white letters: "The Pharaon, Morel and Son of Marseille." It was precisely resembling the other Pharaon, and loaded as that had been with cochineal and indigo. It cast anchor, brailed all sails, and on the deck was Captain Gomard giving orders, and Maître Penellan making signals to Monsieur Morel. To doubt any longer was impossible. There was the evidence of the senses, and 10,000 persons who came to corroborate the testimony. As Morel and his son embraced on the pierhead, in the presence and applause of the whole city witnessing this prodigy, a man, with his face half covered by a black beard, and who, concealed behind the sentry box, watched the scene with delight, uttered these words in a low tone: "Be happy, noble heart. Be blessed for all the good thou hast done and wilt do hereafter, and let my gratitude rest in the shade with your kindness." And with a smile in which joy and happiness were revealed, he left his hiding-place, and without being observed descended one of those flights of steps which serve for debarkation, and hailing three times shouted, "Jacopo! Jacopo! Jacopo!" Then a shallop came to shore, took him on board, and conveyed him to a yacht splendidly fitted up, on whose deck he sprung with the activity of a sailor. Then he once again looked towards Morel, who, weeping with joy, was shaking hands most cordially with all the crowd around him, and thanking with a look the unknown benefactor whom he seemed to be seeking in the skies. "And now," said the unknown, "farewell, kindness, humanity, and gratitude. Farewell to all the feelings that expand the heart. I have been heaven's substitute to recompense the good. Now the God of vengeance yields to me his power to punish the wicked." At these words he gave a signal, and as if only awaiting this signal, the yacht instantly put out to sea.